had the privilege of sharing three conferences with this lady, our speaker. She kind of got known as the cheapest delegate because it only took her about 25 minutes, 30 minutes to get to the conference. I live in just north of Parkersburg, which, you know, and it took me like 9 hours and 10 hours to get there. But I have a lot of admiration for this lady. I like the way she thinks. We think the same way about Al-Anon. And I think Virginia should be very proud of her as their delegate. So I would like to introduce Sherry S.
I always bring my cheat sheets in case I forget my life. I am Sherry Staples, and I am a grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen Family Groups. And I want to clear the air here right away, since this is, I'm so glad you put a clock dead in front of the speaker. I don't have to, like, pretend I don't see the clock. It's right in front of me, so I'll bear in mind there's a dance coming up. I want to clear something up right away here. If you were here this morning to hear our illustrious AA speaker, who defined his beloved wife as high-strung, I just want you to know that I prefer to think of it as high-spirited. I want to thank you all for providing me the opportunity to be here tonight. What a gorgeous place. I wish we had a place as beautiful as this to have our annual convention. This is just, it's hard not to be spiritual surrounded by the mountains. I've always loved the mountains. I always feel, maybe because it's higher up, I think I'm higher to God. I don't know. But it's just beautiful here. It was nice of you to arrange for the blue skies and the puffy clouds and the nice breeze. And Kitty here took credit for it, said she was grateful she could do that for me, and I want to thank her. We had a great time coming up here. We took our time. My husband is a brave man. He's a good recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous because he brought not one but two Al-Anons in the car. And one of them, you know, they used to let me out of town by myself. And then the longer I was in the program, they started, you know, my husband started coming with me and speaking. And now they don't let me out of town without my sponsor. So I came with my husband and my sponsor to just keep me in line. Yeah, right. And he was good and patient and let us, you know, go shopping. And, you know, as long as we fed him a good lunch, he was very good to us. So I want to tell you, sitting up here and watching you all dance to celebrate was so much fun. I mean, there was people like me having a great time. And then there was the people that were kind of, hope nobody notices. You know. Kind of fun. I stand before you tonight, a miracle of the program of Al-Anon. I tell you that my story is really no different from anyone else's story here. And my miracle is no different than anyone else's miracle. Maybe how I got here and how I was able to do the journey to find my miracle is a little different. But if you're a newcomer and you haven't had your miracle tonight, I'm here to tell you, stick with it, because sooner or later, if my miracle happened to me, your miracle will happen to you. I came into this program on Easter Sunday morning, 1980. And I prefer to call that my resurrection day. Kind of stole it from somebody else, but I truly did rise from the dead. And I really do think that most of us, when we come through the doors of AA and Al-Anon, are dead. If not physically, we're spiritually and morally and mentally gone. And I got here at the ripe age of 20. When my parents decided to get married, my mother expressed to her best friend's mother a concern about my father's drinking. And her best friend's mother said to her, "Ah, Jeannie, all Eddie really needs is a loving wife and a good family, and he won't drink anymore. This is the big white flag, which all of us go, didn't see it, didn't happen, wasn't there, you know. And last night I was thinking about that part of my story, and I thought, you know, it's a lot like those, I've never said this before, it's a lot like those cheesy horror movies we go to see where there's a voice going, get out. And the person does, they just don't. Do you ever notice? And it's like, and you're all in the audience going, is she, get out. Are you crazy? And you're living in an alcoholic home, and all those voices are going, get out. And you're just, you know, and like in a horror movie, things go flying through the air. It's true. And things disappear. And levels of alcohol mysteriously go down. I mean, there's a ghost drinking it. It's just like a cheesy horror movie. So anyway, back to the story here. My mother went ahead and married my father. And 7 months after they were married, my mother gave birth to a very large 7-pound preemie. Nice girls like her, that didn't happen to you too in those days. And that was me. And my parents took one look at me and said, my God, this one's more than we can handle, and I'm an only child. My father was tall. He was 6'1". He was thin. He was what you call ruggedly handsome. He sort of had that Clint Eastwood look. He had bright blue eyes. He was a sergeant in the Army, and he looked great in uniform, and I adored him. I absolutely adored him. I still adore men in uniform. I still adore men. But he was my hero, and he fit the bill. I mean, he was just wonderful. And you know, I heard an old-timer in AA, a very old-time speaker, Chuck C., talk about a new pair of glasses. And that's what Al-Anon is for me. When I came into Al-Anon, I received a new pair of glasses which allowed me to look at my life in a different way. And before I came into Al-Anon, if you had asked me what my childhood was like, I would have told you that it was full of misery, uncertainty, and fear. But after I came in Al-Anon and put on my new pair of glasses, I came to see that the childhood that I thought was so horrible was actually quite wonderful. It had wonderful, wonderful times to it. It just had really bad moments, okay? And my father, he was a singer. He used to sing professionally, and I later sang professionally for a while. And he loved history, and we would go and see historic places, and he would teach me things, and he loved the theater, and he used to take us to the theater, and we'd dress up and spend money we didn't have. And, you know, and he was just romantic and wonderful. And all of the things that this day that I love, which I love the theater, I love good music, I love history. I'm really sick of Stonewall Jackson, but I'm learning to live with it. But all of those things my alcoholic father gave to me. My mother, on the other hand, she was, I always found her rather boring in my youth. She was steady, easy as you go, very straight, down the line, da da da. And I thought she was tremendously boring. And she used to, she worked for the telephone company for 35 years, and she hated her job. And I couldn't understand, I thought it was stupid of her to do that. I couldn't understand why somebody would work at a job they hated for 35 years. Well, I don't know if she hated it the whole time, but as long as I can remember, she had. And why would you do that, you know? And when I came into Al-Anon, what I learned to see was that the woman that was boring and did the job she hated was the person that provided the money, that kept the lights on and put the food on the table, and was the steady source that kept our home going. Because you see, dashing, handsome, uniformed daddy drank the money away. You know, he drank the money away. Yes, we were an Army family. We traveled a lot. And when people would say to me, what was your favorite place to live? I would always say Fort Knox, Kentucky. And the reason I used to say that was because that was the last place I remember alcohol not being part of our home. But one day when I was 6 years old, I was sitting at the kitchen table, and my father came home, and I knew he was drunk. And you know, I really don't know how a six-year-old knows what drunk is, but I knew he was. And I've heard people say, well, my kids never saw me drunk, so I didn't hurt them. And if you ever hear someone say that, I ask you to reconsider in your heart, or if you ever reconsider that in your heart, because children always know when alcohol is a problem in the home, even if they don't see the drinking parent. And most of the time it's because they see the non-drinking parent, because it's the non-drinking parent that acts crazy and the alcoholic goes to bed. But I knew that we had a problem. And from then on in, I don't remember alcohol not being a part of our home. I mean, it was like Gene, Ed, Sherry, and old granddad. Because how our days were measured was by the level of the old granddad bottle. You know, if it was down, it was going to be a bad day. If it stayed consistent, it was going to be pretty good. It took me a couple years to realize that sometimes there was another influence on the level. But, you know, that was how, and I learned to dread the sound of ice cracking into the ice bin. Isn't that strange? It's still a sound that makes my skin crawl. And because you never knew, was it iced tea? Was it vodka and orange juice? Was it bourbon in the iced tea? You know, being in Kentucky, we were there quite a bit. And boy, moonshine, gosh, that was a great thing too, you know. And so you just never knew. And so that's how you live your life. And I remember one time being 8 or 9 years old and going to church and hearing a well-meaning minister say, good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And so I thought, well, I don't know what I've done, but there's something evil in me. Because why would a good person live like this? Why would this be a problem in a good person's home? And you know, I don't know how, I mean, I carried that forever. You know, it just seemed like forever. And now, I do want to clarify. Now, when my mother was a telephone operator, and she worked odd hours. And when I was young, and my mother was working, my father took care of me, and I'm here to say that when he did take care of me, he never got drunk. And he was a good, loving father, and he took very good care of me. But as I became a teenager, and he retired, and we settled in New Jersey, where my mother was from, the drinking had begun to escalate. I mean, it was all of the stereotypical things you hear. And things began to change in our home. And I began to change, and now I was no longer sad and upset and afraid. I was sad, upset, and afraid, and really angry, you know. And the rage in me, you know, puberty didn't help, but the rage in me was just enormous. Because why? Why was this happening? And then violence entered our home. And I'm here to tell you that I wish I could tell you that the violence was solely on the part of my father, but it was not. He would come home drunk, and I'd get in his face, and he'd get in mine, and he'd slap me, and I'd spit in his face and curse at him, and he'd slap me again, and I had these really long fingernails, and at that time I didn't have to pay for them, and I would just take them, and I'd rake them across his face, you know, and what you get in a situation like that is when you wake up in the morning, you have a sick, hungover, guilty alcoholic sitting on one side of the breakfast table, and you have a sick, lonely, scared 16-year-old sitting on the other side, and I've got bruises on my face, and he's got rake marks, you know, the sign of his shame and pity down his face. I mean, awful place to be. And, you know, you instinctively know you don't tell your friends what's happening. You don't tell them what's happening. And I remember when I came into Al-Anon, an old-timer, shortly after I was in, said to me, you know, Sherry, stop volunteering for the violence. That was back in the days when we weren't as kind as we are now. And damn good thing is what I say. I didn't need kindness at that time. And I was incensed. And I said, what do you mean? I am a victim. And she said to me, Sherry, you know, first of all, spitting in his face, cursing at him, and getting in a drunk's face is not smart. And you know, sometimes you can tell when you go in that when the tide, and you could always tell when that tide's turning and things are going to get ugly. And she said, you know, pick up your stuff and leave. Duh. What a concept. Leave? Yeah, leave. Well, I was going to show it didn't work. So like the next time I went home, and at that point now I was 20, I went home and things were getting ugly. I thought, okay. So when he went into the bathroom, good opportunity, picked up the pocketbook and left. And you know what? He didn't have rake marks down his face. I didn't have black and blue marks the next morning. And maybe he felt guilty and shame for drinking, but there was no guilt and shame on his part for me or I for him. And that is what the program's about. One tiny act can change the whole dynamic of where you're living. And, you know, we say to people, you know, we try to tell them these simple things, and No, I have to go pay $100 to the psychiatrist to learn stuff, you know. And it's these, I'm here to tell you, the simplest things are what saved my life. Not the tough stuff, not the complicated stuff, not buzzing through the 12, 12, and 12, but doing those simple suggestions that people said that I thought wouldn't work because, my God, they're simple. I had this solution for alcoholism. You see, I was smart. And I don't know if I'm smart or not. All I know is I have a really great memory, and you feed me information, and I can take tests really well. And I'll tell you, like a good Al-Anon, I'll tell you exactly what you want to hear, okay? And my solution to the problem was I was going to stay smart, graduate high school with honors, get into a good college, get a good degree, get a good job, and get out. And I never, ever would marry an alcoholic. I didn't have golf on my list. And also, for those of you who heard our illustrious AA speaker this morning, when I married him, he was a bowler, not a golfer. He was a golfer hiding in a bowling shirt, you know. And then bowling was 2 hours, golfing is five. It's a whole different, you know, acceptance is the key to harmony, you know. So anyway, when I was 20 years old, my father hit a school bus. And it made the front page of the paper. And that which I had hidden for so long was stripped away because it made the front page of the paper. Heck, I was dating a cop who was on the shift that busted him. And fortunately, there was only a couple of children on the school bus and they weren't hurt. He had gone through the windshield. He was a mess. But you know, it hit the papers. And I had my first, my first act of acceptance, and that was, what am I going to do? You know, I instinctively knew that morning there wasn't a thing. The secret was out, and it was almost a relief. It was like, well. And what I learned from that situation was those people who were really my friends and cared about me and really did care about my dad and loved Eddie, the one who wasn't drunk all the time, they called and said, what can we do? Is there anything we can do? House pop? And those that didn't disappeared. It's a horrible way to decide who is and who isn't your friends, but hey, it works, you know? And so, he was put in jail. And he was going to deal with some time, probably. And so I had a cousin who came over, and he 12-stepped my father. And so my father went to a treatment center. Now, think what you like about treatment centers. But in 1980, they weren't very prolific. And this was one of the first treatment centers, and it was a wonderful place for my father, and it was a wonderful place for me. And I know he went there partially because he thought it would help beat jail. It didn't all the way, but it did reduce his time. And what was special about this place was it was one of the first places that was treating families of alcoholics. And so he did his typical 28 days, and for the first 10 days they detox, and then they let you come see him, and it was Easter Sunday morning. And first we went to see the counselor, and she took me into her office by myself. And she said to me, do you feel crazy? Do you feel insane? And you know, that was my real fear, because I knew in the Fisher family, my father's side of the family, there was my grandfather had three sisters, and all of them were flamboyant. One was a jazz singer and dancer, and one was a harpist in the Detroit Philharmonic. And they were all just, they were great looking ladies, and they all wore they had pictures of them they were just romantic flapper outfits. They were just great looking ladies. And the thing was, they all died in insane asylums. And my cousins and I used to say, Fisher women go crazy. And after my grandfather died, several years when I was in the program, after he died, we found out they didn't die of insanity. They were all alcoholics. And see, in my family, it's better to be crazy than to be a drunk. So I thought I was crazy. I mean, that was my fear. I thought, well, geez, the Fisher curse has hit me, you know. And it was kind of gothic, you know. It was kind of, ooh. But I didn't think the ending was going to be real pretty. And I just broke down and said, God, yes. And she said, what if I told you we could help? And I said, oh, please do. And so I went through this treatment center. And it was a wonderful place for me to be. And part of the treatment was you had to attend Al-Anon meetings. And you had to attend the one at their treatment center on Sundays. And then you had to attend a minimum of two during the week. And I went, and I thought they would know if I didn't go. And in those days, I mean, they didn't tell you that they didn't know. They let you think they did, and I went. And I went in that Easter Sunday morning, and I had, it was 1980, and I had on a powder blue three-piece pantsuit with big shoulder pants and big, big platform shoes, and I thought I looked great. And by the way, my babysitter wears that now, and she thinks she's original, and she's a comeback, and I'm now old enough to be part of a comeback, and that's a shocker. But I looked great from the neck down, but from the neck up, I was this thunderstorm. It was this boiling volcano of anger, and by God, I went in there, and they were laughing and having a good time, and they looked good, and I thought, my job is to take you down. You know, that's my job, because you don't understand how bad it is, you know, and they say things like, keep coming back, easy does it, first things first, and oh, you know, that's tough, this swallow, and it's, you know, it's hard enough when you're 20 and rammy, you know, so anyway, I didn't really care a great deal for that, and but I was also going to this group, and in this group, they mixed alcoholics with family members. And what that did for me was I began to hear the alcoholic side of the story. And I began to feel, my God, an Al-Anon slip. I began to feel compassion for the alcoholic. And I began to hear their stories. And there were some people that were getting ready to leave the group and some people in the middle. And, you know, there was newcomers. And so there was always people at different levels of getting into this and getting through this. And I learned to feel compassion for the alcoholic. And more importantly, I learned it was okay to love an alcoholic. Because I was getting tired of feeling bad because I loved an alcoholic. And I was getting tired of people not loving my alcoholic, you know. And I learned it was okay. And I had this mean, nasty counselor. And he was an Army sergeant. Oh, geez. You know, just like my dad. And he was also he was a double winner. And for a while, he acted as my sponsor. And the reason was I went to meetings and I was 20. And all these women were 40. And now I'm 40, you know. And they were so premenopausal, you know. they all wanted to be my mom, and they thought it was thrilling that they had their what they saw as their own daughter in there, and they wanted to be motherly to me. And I instinctively, at that time, was something I was smart enough to know that these people would not be giving me what I needed. And so I drifted towards the men in Al-Anon that were older, that were mean. Because I'm one of those, but you have to be mean to me, I'm sorry. I just, you know, be kind to me, I'm going to walk all over you. And at least in the beginning now, I'm a kinder and gentler person. And this gentleman said to me, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to do the steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, and you will do step 4 and 5, or you will not leave this treatment center. That's what you will do. We didn't, in those days, they didn't tell, oh, wait several years, do it, you know, just do it. And we're going to tell you how to do it, and I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to, he says, and I'm going to tell you who you're going to make amends to. It wasn't like I was going to come up with a list. He was, and he said to me, the first person, in those days, they didn't tell you to put yourself at the top of the list either, and they weren't kind and generous in that way either. He said, the first person you're going to make amends to is your mother. And I said, I will not. And he said, you will too, or you're not leaving. You're going to look real old sitting here. You're not going. And I said, you know, I'm not coming back, but I did. And she was the one I hated. You know, And the reason I hated that woman is I could understand what my father's problem was. I mean, he drank. It was obvious. You could smell him. He weaved. But I didn't understand what was keeping her from being a sane human being. And most of all, I didn't understand why she didn't keep me safe. I really didn't understand why she didn't keep me safe. And I later came to see that if I wanted compassion and understanding in my part of the sickness, I had to be willing to give it to her. And so my mother and I began to make amends one to another, and we began to go to meetings together, and we made this deal. And it was, when we walked into the meetings, we were Jean and Sherry, and we sat at opposite ends of the table, and we were not allowed to talk about anything that happened at that meeting whatsoever outside of the meeting. And we were allowed to say anything that we felt we needed to say in the meeting, and it worked. And we began to slowly heal, and that was one of the greatest miracles of my program, and it still is today. A lot of times when my husband doesn't go with me out of town, they send my mother with me. And people love her. She's ditzy, she's silly, she's a wonderful human being, and I never saw that until I got in the program. And I had this terrible fear of losing my dad, you know, and but I kept going to those two meetings, and unfortunately he did not, after he got out and did his time in jail, he did not stay sober. He then just had periods of intermittent sobriety, and they were very infrequent. The other thing they said to me one night in this home group I had was, Sherry, you are a big baby. Shut up and grow up. And I said, I'm never coming back. I hate you people. Except that the next week, I really wanted to be back there. And I thought, God, swallow it and go back in and prove them wrong. So I'm going to prove them wrong. And another thing that was said to me is, Sherry, you think you are so smart. And I was in college at the time, and I had not gone away to college. Fortunately, in New Jersey, there's a number of good schools. And I was, first of all, there wasn't the money to go away to school. And my dad's and mom's finances look good on paper, and we all know where that went. But there wasn't a lot of money for that. And I was afraid that if I left that house, those two people would kill one another. I really was. And so I stayed and commuted to a very good school most of the time I was in college. And so I'm in college at that time, and I really, this ego of mine, you know, and this person said to me, Sherry, you think you were so damn smart, and you know, you want to philosophize and think through this program, and you can't think it. When you go to a meeting, you leave your brains outside the door and bring in your heart, because we don't care how you feel or what you think. We just want you to listen with your heart. And to this day, that's what I try and do. I try to not be very bright in meetings, because when I start to get too smart, that's when I start to get, you know, off onto tangents that I don't need to be in. And it's interesting. I've noticed in the program, for a while we had a Harvard PhD in one of the groups I attended, and that man had the hardest time getting it. I mean, the smarter they are. And that's one of the things anonymity is for me. Because I was such a snob when I came into the program that if you were a doctor and you were a lawyer and he was a garbage man and you were the water meter man, I would listen to the doctor and the lawyer. But because I didn't know who you were, what you did, or what your last name was, and what your family status was, I listened and listened to those who made sense. And a lot of times, one of the guys was our water meter man. He was much smarter. And I learned, that's what anonymity is to me. It strips away those trappings that we judge as worthwhile out in the real world. I did two years of Al-Anon in New Jersey. Hard time, yeah. And then I graduated college with honors, of course, because I still had this ego, and I still had some faith that was going to get me somewhere, so I'm Miss Brain. And I graduated college with honors, and I sent out resumes, and lo and behold, I got a job exactly where I wanted to be. We used to vacation in Williamsburg, Virginia, and I thought it was a beautiful place. And I got a job in Hampton, Virginia, and so Miss New Jersey came down to take the South one more time. My mother-in-law likes, I told people this today, my mother-in-law is from Lynchburg, Virginia, and she has a gentle, quiet southern voice, and she says to me, Sherry, you have married a Virginian and you have given birth to one, but you will never, ever be a Virginian. Fine, just fine. I came down and I was a perpetual goody-goody at home. It was very disgusting. And I never did, and I'm always slow, you know, while the people were acting out, I was still Miss Halo. I came down to Virginia and the first time away from home, and all hell broke loose. You know, I spent 2 years trying to become an alcoholic, and I did a pretty good job of it, except my husband says, the problem is I would get to drinking and I didn't like the feeling, so I'd stop, and Doug always says, well, for God's sake, you're supposed to drink through that. And his sponsor calls it the amateur hour, you know, and I occasionally will have a glass of wine, and Joe takes off his watch and times in it. At 45 minutes, he's like, it's evaporating, drink it, drink it, drink it. Yeah. But there was this guy I worked with, and he was tall and thin, and he had been in the Army, and he had big sad eyes like my dad, and he needed somebody. And you know, I need you. Especially around 1:30 in the morning when they're playing those last slow songs. Mine, 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 mine. And I'm here to tell you, if I had, at that time, I was working Al-Anon like you worked the Rotary Club. I was going to meetings, having a cup of coffee, sitting down, saying what I thought you wanted me to say, and going home. I did not have a sponsor, was not working the steps, and I was not doing anything. I was not going to coffee after meetings. I was going for 1 hour a week or hour and a half a week, and that was all I was doing. And I've heard people say, oh, just come in and sit in. And you'll get the program. Oh, no, you won't. You've got to do something. I mean, this is a program of action. And if you sit there, it does not come by osmosis. And I'm here to tell you that's exactly what got me into trouble. You know, I just did what I thought I was supposed to do. I didn't do what I was, you know, I didn't do the right thing. Because he was sitting at my kitchen table one day, and they had a flyer come around from a hospital that had a treatment program, and there was a picture of a hand chained to a glass. And he said, I feel like that. Now, if I had been working my problem and if I had been working my program, I'd have been out that door. Instead, and it took me several years to remember thinking this. Instead, I thought, I couldn't fix my father, but I can fix you. And I'm here to tell you that I've heard people say that alcoholism is a fatal illness, and I believe that 100%. And I'm also here to tell you that I believe that the untreated family disease of alcoholism is a fatal illness. Because we die mentally and spiritually, and sometimes we die physically. We put ourselves in dangerous situations. We get into a car with a drunk. We stay in violent homes. And sometimes we commit the violence and we go to jail for killing. And we put ourselves into situations where our life is in danger, and we don't think about us. And I'm here to tell you that we die. And a lot of people die out there of this disease. And that's damn near what happened to me, because this man beat me on a daily basis. And I'm so smart, but you see, I have this ego and this pride. Pride will kill you, you better believe it will. And I can't tell people what I've gotten myself into, because I'm smart, I have a degree, I have a wonderful job, I had a great job, and I am allowing this to happen, and I'm supposed to be a member of Al-Anon, and look what I've done. So I don't tell anybody. Now, the truth is, a lot of people knew. They knew, but I don't tell anybody. And he's just, I mean, locking me in rooms and not letting me out a week, I mean, it just got crazier and crazier and crazier, you know, and the descent into hell was unbearable. And I've heard it said that in order to be reborn, you have to descend into hell. I don't know. Let's not go too deep, but I surely did. Please don't go as deep as I did. And I kept trying to break it off, and he would stalk me, and so I'd go back. And finally, I'll tell you what finally did the job. He wouldn't let me go to a Bruce Springsteen concert. And when you're from New Jersey, you go to a Bruce Springsteen concert, come hell or high water, you go. And it infuriated me. I thought, by God, that, you know, not anything else. Now, that shows you how bizarre and sick I am at this point, right? He's working out of town, and so I broke up with him on the phone. I said, I don't want, and I had broke off with him many times, but this time I was, by God, I was doing it this time. And I said, when you get in this Friday, I want you to come to the house and pick up your stuff and get out. And I figured, well, they would leave work around 6-7 o'clock that night, which is what they were doing, and he'd get there on 10:30. And so I thought, I was real tense about the situation, and I thought, I'm going to go take a hot bath. So I drew a hot bath, and before I took the bath, he came in, and he was drunk. And he walked through the door, and he slammed me into the wall, and I don't know how it happened, but somehow we were in that bathroom. And he proceeded to put my head underwater. And he'd put me there, and then he'd bring me up, and then he'd put me there, and we went. And I remember thinking, what a horrible, stupid place to die, in the bathroom, in a bathtub. And I was fighting him so hard, and what I finally did, I guess, was I went limp, and he let me go. And I was able to calm him down, and I got him to sit on the toilet seat lid, and I said, just sit here, dear. I'm going to go get us a glass of iced tea. And I went out of the hall, and instead of going left into the kitchen, for some reason that night I had left my keys on the table by the front door. And I didn't, that's not where I kept them. And my pocketbook was there too. Maybe one of them ghosts put it there for me, a friendly one, I suppose. And instead of going left into the kitchen, I went right and got those keys and went out that door. Ran to the car and got in, got where I could find a phone booth. And you know, I found a phone booth behind some tall bushes, so he couldn't find me. And he was like, God said, phone booth here. And I called some friends and I said, I'm soaking wet. It was January 6th. It was sleeting out. And I said, I don't have any underwear on. And I did. I had a flannel shirt and nothing else on, and I was drenched to the skin. And they came and got me. And I had to do what I had to do. I had to go down. And at that time, it was mid-80s. And I went down to the magistrate, and they refused to take a warrant out on him. He said, oh, sweetie, you'll go back to him. And he was only when he found out what I did for a living, he decided to take me seriously, and they put a couple warrants out. And I finally, in order to get him out of my life, I had to get a lawyer and threaten to put a warrant out for attempted murder. And I told his parents, I'll sign this if you don't do something with him. And they sent him to Texas. And I hear that he's back in Virginia. I've never seen him, and the good Lord knows, I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I want to. And he keeps him away. Now, am I still going to meetings? Yes, I am. Am I working a program? No, I'm not. Do I do it now? No. I find another guy. Now, this one didn't drink, but he was an adult. His father was an alcoholic, and he had all the isms, so along he comes. And I latched onto him. And what finally had to happen was he went to Europe for 6 weeks and he didn't come back for 2 years. Boy, I mean, you know, the length some of us have to go to. And the interesting thing about that was, I mean, he was a good man. I mean, he was not a bad person. And it was not a violent or bad relationship. It was, I was very needy and clingy to him, but God said, this is enough, I'm going to send you to Europe, it's time to bring you to your knees. And at that time, I had lost my job. Now, I've never been fired, I am the uber worker, I'm the ultimate worker, but they keep closing my departments, and I'm out of a job again, and so I was unemployed, and I don't have a man. And the two things that defined who I was, what I did for a living, and a guy, are gone. And I have nothing. Nothing. Because that's all I knew that I was. That's all I knew. And I have a best friend, and she came down to see me, and we played Isn't Life Great. And before she went to get on the plane, she said, I was taken to the airport that day, and she said, I really don't want to leave, Sherry, because I know that you're faking this, and I know you're in the worst place you've ever been. And I just came unglued. See, what she didn't know and what no one knew at that time was I was basically spending my days in bed. And we were talking about pets, and I had this cat that God put in my life, I swear he put her in my life. And she looked like a little round bowling ball with itty-bitty feet. She was just feet. A little black bowling ball, little tiny feet. And there were days when I would lay in that bed and not get up. I'd be smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, playing Patsy Cline and crying. And that cat, to me, was the only thing in the world that loved me. And she would lay there and purr. And I mean, I called her God with fur on. I mean, that's what she was to me. And that was, I was getting up, going to the store, buying cat food, milk, and cigarettes, and coffee. And going to bed. And listening to Patsy Cline and crying. And so I called my doctor, and I have a very good doctor, and I still have him. And I said, I can't cope, I can't deal with this, I have to go, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he said, well, can you make it till tomorrow? And I said, sure. And so down I went, and I just sat there and cried, and he kept handing me tissues, and I kept taking them and handing them, and I'm just bawling my eyes out. And I tell you this because some of us feel guilty about this, and he said, Sherry, you're depressed. He said, and you've got pretty good reasons to be depressed. He said, but I'm going to give you something for it. I said, oh my God, I can't do that. My father's an alcoholic. Were you listening to me? My father's an alcoholic. I don't do drugs. I can't drink. I'm going to turn. No. And he said, well, Sherry, this stuff is pretty mild. It'll help you cope. And we give it to kids that wet the bed, so they won't wet the bed either, which I wasn't aware was my problem. But I didn't wet the bed. But what else he said, and this is why professionals knowing about us is so important. What else he said was, didn't I hear you say you're an Al-Anon? And I said, yeah. And he said, how many meetings do you go to? I said, one a week. And he said,
aren't they free?
Told you I'm smart, right? Did I figure that one out? No. And I said, well, matter of fact, there. I said, you know, if I were you, I'd be going to every meeting I could get to. And so, I mean, I popped up like a mole. I was in every meeting on the Virginia Peninsula. I mean, I was at the day ones, I was at the night ones, I went to two and three, and one lady said, do you ever go home? No, you know, and I was six, almost 7 years in the program at that time. It takes what it takes. You know, and sometimes people say to me, why do you hang with that person? She'll never get it. Well, hell, it took me forever, you know. So I began to go to meetings, and I started to go to the Sunday AA meeting, and they had started this meeting, and it was a Sunday meeting, but they wanted Al-Anon participation, and they weren't calling it an Al-Anon meeting. We weren't breaking any traditions. And hey, I wasn't dating anybody, you know, so I could get up early on Sunday morning. And I started going, you know, and I started hearing really solid recovery. And, you know, when you're single and you're away from home, Sundays are like the worst days. You're sure everybody's home eating roast beef and mashed potatoes like we ate tonight. And it was a lonely time. And so, you know, I started going to the Sunday morning meeting, and you know what? I started to have good days. I started to have really good days. And I started to hang around with three people, and then Ed, Joan, and Bill. And Ed, Joan, and Bill were, Joan and Bill were in both programs, and Ed was an alcoholic, and they were all older than me. Ed was my father's age. And Joan was about 10 years older than me. She was this gorgeous British lady. She still is a gorgeous British lady. And Bill, who was kind of an odd little fella. And we began to go around places together, and I learned how to be Sherry without a man. Something I had never been. You see, I always had one in the wings. Lose this one, get that one. Lose this one, get that one. You know, from the time I was 16 on. And, you know, I began to like it. I was okay alone. Matter of fact, I liked being alone. I began to find a higher power. I had time to think, time to talk, time to write. I was enjoying it a lot. And these people taught me how to live, and we had a great time. And that's the other thing about AA and Al-Anon. I love that fly. You know what we do to people like you. And in Al-Anon and AA, we learn to have friends, and they can be older than us, and they can be younger than us. You know, I have friends of all ages. And, you know, when I got married, all my bridesmaids were, you know, in their 40s. It was menopausal bridesmaids. And and I say this, and it gives me great sadness, because Ed was a dear friend, and we just lost him. And it just, I lost a part of my recovery. It was like losing somebody who had been medicine to me, you know. He was somebody who brought me here. Anyway, I got a great job. I had the lady in my company was great, but I had this horrible boss I worked for, and he wasn't an alcoholic. He should have been, because he was nasty. He was nasty all the time, and we would fight all the time. And one day I was in an Al-Anon meeting, and they read the book on, they were reading the ODAP book, and they read that page on courtesy and treating a man with dignity and respect, and something clicked, and I said, I wonder if I treated Bill like an alcoholic, if that might not work. And so I started to treat him with dignity and respect, and I refused to fight with him, and I refused to get into these, you know, yelling matches, and And, you know, when somebody's raging at you and you're being nice to them, first of all, it really pisses them off to begin with, you know. So my motives weren't really pure, but, you know, sooner or later it diffuses the fire. There's no use fighting with somebody if you're not going to fight back. And you know what? We began to like one another. And we began to work okay together. And I'm really glad we did, because he died 2 years ago at the age of 45, and I had no regrets. And I felt bad for him, because he died very angry, and he was an unhappy person. And I don't ever think he did become a happy person, and I'm sorry for that. I hope he's at peace. But life was going well. And one day at work, I got this call, and my mother said, your father's colon has ruptured, and he's in a trauma center in Camden, New Jersey. You have to come quickly. And so I did. And I got there, and his colon had ruptured, and peritonitis had set in, but they were able to get all the infection, and they had given him a temporary colostomy, and it looked like he was going to make it. And he was sitting up in bed in ICU, and there was my daddy. And he was reading the newspaper because the Pistons were in the playoffs. I remember that because Isaiah's picture was on the front. And the page was shaking. And I said to the nurse, we were so afraid of infection. Is he getting an infection? And he said, no, he's getting the DTs. And I said, oh, no. My dad doesn't get DTs. He's been detoxed many, many times. Doesn't happen. So we went to bed. I went home, went to bed that night. And the next morning at 6 o'clock, they called and they said, your father's dying. Get up here quickly. And he was not dying from the diverticulitis or the surgery. He was dying from the DTs. And every organ in his body shut down with the exception of his heart. And he was very athletic, thank God, because his heart's the only thing that saved him. And his kidney shut down, and he basically shook and screamed and picked at things and pulled things off, and all of his vital signs were going. It was, if you don't believe alcoholism is a disease, I invite you to look at that sometime. It's really horrible. And I didn't know what to do, and I had this ODAT book, and I still have it, and it's my ODAT book. I don't use any other one but that one, and I couldn't read it because I just, you know, you read and the words don't make any sense, but I carried it around, and it worked. And in the cover, I had everybody's phone numbers, and I would call from the phone outside of ICU, and I would just walk around that book, and for some reason, it gave me comfort, and it worked. And another one of those, you walk around with the ODAT book, it will work. I mean it. It does. When you need some comfort, it works. And lo and behold, they were able, they had a young resident doctor who had studied some alcoholism. He's told me that they usually get about 6 weeks study in alcoholism, and that's all. And most of their cases have, a lot of the cases of alcohol related, about 50%. And so they put him in a coma and brought him down, and they kept him there for 5 weeks, and then slowly brought him up.
This is the end of side one. Stop your recorder now and turn the tape over.
And they told him not to drink. Duh. And so we brought him home, and I had my daddy back. I mean, he was sober, and he was wonderful, and his eyes were clear again. They were so blue. And there he was. I mean, it was my daddy again. And I wanted to tell him how much I liked him being sober, and I wanted to take him to an AA meeting. And I had a sponsor at the time, different sponsor, and she said to me, well, Sherry, you can tell him that, but tell him only once. It's controlling. Just tell him once how you feel. So, but she said, but pick a good. Pick a good time because this is it. This is your big chance, and that's all you get. And so I told him in the garden, I said, you know, Daddy, I really love what, you know, you sober. I just love how this is, and I really wish you would stay this way, and I really wish you would go to AA. And he said, baby, I know where there's meetings. I'll get there if I need it. And, you know, when they reversed the colostomy 6 months later, he started to drink again. But you know, at that point, the relationship I had with my dad was so good, it no longer mattered. When he was sober, he was my dad, and we had a great relationship. And when he was drunk, I didn't accept his phone calls when he was drunk. I chose not to be around him when he was drunk. And it's easier when you're 350 miles away, of course, but I refused to let that relationship deteriorate ever again. And I'm really glad of that, because he was a great person with a bad, horrible, fatal illness. He was a great person. Well, this friend Ed that we just lost had this friend Doug. And being uncontrolling human beings that members of Alcoholics Anonymous are, my friend Ed thought that me and Doug would make a good pair. Ed fixed Doug and I up. And what he forgot to tell me was Doug had a girlfriend. And I've been 2.5 years without a man, which was my own choice. I decided I needed to get well before I could stumble. And I thought, well, I didn't wait 2.5 years for this. You know. And so I said, I'm going to let him go. I don't need this. I'll let it go. And I said this at a convention a couple years ago, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I didn't. I mean, I let him go, but this Sunday morning meeting was a breakfast meeting, and they had a buffet, and on the buffet was fruit and all kinds of stuff. And Doug would sit across the room, and he went to this meeting, and he would sit across the room. And so I began to get this fruit, and I would eat it in a very strange and provocative manner. Now to clear this up, I never did bananas, I swear. But said, okay, you know, I could do things with strawberries, and it didn't look too obvious. And this one friend of ours, who later turned out to be in our, he was in our wedding, and I didn't know him very well, the time he came up to us, he said, by God, I don't know if he's noticing, but you got to stop that, I can't sing. I'd like to tell you that was an original idea, but I got it from a movie. But anyway, a few months later, Doug didn't have a girlfriend anymore, and Doug came back. And if you heard him this morning, he began to pursue me in a rather vigorous manner. And, you know, and I was scared. I was scared. I mean, I had just started to like being single, and along he comes. And I mean, we hadn't dated a month, and he's talking about marriage. You know, alcoholics, when they want what they want, by God, they want it. And I told him not to get the ring, and he did, and he proposed to me at an AA assembly. Now, that should tell you how my life was going to go. And so I remember going to bed that night after he proposed, and we were, as my mother put it, shacking up. I used to think sex was the big deal in a relationship, but I think it's socks. And the reason I say that is, if you wake up one morning and you open your drawers and men's socks are in it, you're in trouble, you know. And the socks were in my drawer, and geez, here we go again. So I went to bed that night, and I had this little dirty secret, and it's something I struggle with this very day, and that is that good things happen to good people. And I'm real used to my life being tough. And see, girls like me don't get married. They don't have. They don't live happily ever after. They don't have houses with white people. Doesn't happen to people like me. And so I just knew it's all going to be snatched away. And I had said yes, but I never really thought I'd get married. I really thought that something was going to happen. And I would tell this to this really kind lady I loved in the program, who was one of the members of my wedding, and she would get really, and she was so kind and gentle with people, and once again, she'd get ugly with me. Oh, shut up, Sharon, keep on going, you know? And so we began to plan this big wedding, you know, and in the North, we do them on the large side, and my mother and dad were thrilled. Dad loved Doug. I mean, Doug loved sports, and Doug was an alcoholic. I mean, they should have gotten married. They got along so well. And it was the first one I brought home that he liked. I mean, he was threatened, and that was so important to me. And his baby was getting married, and I couldn't wait for him to walk me down the aisle. I just couldn't wait. And about 3 weeks before we had come home for Labor Day weekend, and he didn't look too good. And I asked him to please go have a physical. And they found a spot on my father's lung. And I just, and he said, you know, he's a good Army sergeant, he drank hard, and he smoked hard. He smoked Camels without filters. This is not a good thing, you know, not a good thing. And I was scared. And I knew the chances of him having lung cancer were pretty high. And I just didn't know how I was going to do that. I didn't know how I was going to lose my father of cancer. I did not want to watch this man die slow, because he was this great outdoorsman. He was this vigorous person. And I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And he died the day of the biopsy. And I lost my greatest hero. Still, it's been years. Still miss him every day. But let me tell you how good my God is. About 3 weeks before my father died, my father had these dreams. He always wanted to go on a cruise, and he wanted to see Alaska, and he loved to fish. So 3 weeks before my father died, he and my mother had gone on a two-week cruise to Alaska, where he caught a 48-pound keeper salmon. And see, God had given my father all his dreams. And it was like he left because he knew that I had someone who was going to be there for me like he had been there for me. So we buried him with his boots on. He loved cowboy boots. He always wore them after he got out of the Army. And buried him with his boots on and a bolo tie. And I put this salmon carnation fish there. And people would say, that's so spiritual. It is not. It's a salmon. You know? Okay, anyway, but the wedding went on, you know. And we kept going, you know, and Joe, Doug has a sponsor, Joe. And it was, you know, 1990, and Joe had a purple nose, like Doug said. He had bad teeth, veins all over his cheeks, and he wore leisure suits in 1990. And I said to Doug, oh my God, does Joe have to be the best man? And he said, love me, love my sponsor. And I'm happy to say that with some years and some work, Joe had got he now has had his teeth fixed. The nose is always going to be the nose, but it is less fluorescent. He married a wonderful lady in Al-Anon who threw out all the leisure suits, and he looks right good these days, you know. But they used to sit him in front of the door to AA, and they'd say to newcomers, keep on drinking and you'll look like that, you know. Something I want to talk about real briefly before I close, and I know dance is coming up, I'm watching the clock. When I was going to the Sunday morning meeting, and before I was dating Doug, and I told you I had nothing to do, one day at this Sunday morning meeting, a lady in Al-Anon said to me, what are you doing this afternoon? And, you know, the answer was nothing. And she said, well, you know, we're having a breakfast committee meeting, why don't you come to the committee meeting? Well, I didn't have anything to do. And on the peninsula in Virginia, we have a really pretty large breakfast, and we get, you know, 300-400 people sometimes for this breakfast. And so I went, and I don't think I did a thing except I might have taken coffee cups and put them in the sink, and I think they let me read the 12 steps, and I think I screwed them up. I'm not sure, but I think I did. And that's all they let me do. And I laughed because I was talking to somebody last night, and she said she wanted to run her first convention, and I wanted to run the breakfast, and they wouldn't let me. But I started doing service work because I had somewhere to go. I had nothing to do. It gave me something to put my energy into. Yes, I am hyper. I will always be that way. So it's better for me to put my energy into something fruitful than something not. And so I began to do these things, and I began to get better faster. And I just don't understand people who don't do service, because it's a triangle, you know? And it's recovery, unity, and service, and it's a triangle, and it's not one leg, it's not just recovery. You know, service work is part of getting better. If you're not doing service work, you're not getting better. You're staying still. You need to do service work to keep growing. That's what we do. We reach out to one another. If you're sitting there and not doing it, your recovery starts to slow down and you stagnate. And it's part of a three-pronged program. It's not separable. It's united. And I was just meeting people and going places and doing things, and it got better and better. I got elected alternate GR, and the GR went and got in a car accident, and I had to be GR for a year. And then she came back and took it away from me, which is a good thing. And then I became GR, and then I was 8 months pregnant, and everybody thought I'd make a good DR. Now, you tell you how people sicker my ear, they elect an 8 months pregnant woman DR. And I was stupid enough to do it, and I became DR. And while I was DR, I was at this assembly, and this woman at the time was not my sponsor. But she's tall and she's lanky and she talks like this, and y'all heard her last night. And she came in and she sort of drapes that body across my bed and says, I think we should put in a bid for the RSS for the Southeast. And I think your district ought to do it. And I said, oh my God, Juanita, I don't know if we can handle that. And I started, you know, and she said, just put the bid in. And then later on, after we were getting the bid together, it occurred to me that because we were really close to the WSO, which had just moved there less than a year before, chances were, he's a problem. I think he likes, anyway. I knew we'd probably get this silly RSS because people wanted to be near the WSO. Well, by God, we did. And she was so excited, and I thought, oh, dear God. Yeah. And so, and then the other deal she forgot to tell me was, we're going to let you be the chairman. She forgot to tell me that, and so I'm now the chairman. But this is how she taught me to do service work, and this is how I've tried to do it. And she said, you do the job, and I'll be there to help you. If you're chairman, I'll be there for you. And we'll do this together. And she has always been there for me. And
right after the RSS, there was time to elect a delegate, and people started coming up to me and saying, we'd like you to stand, and I didn't want to do that. And people began to come up and talk about their experiences as delegates everywhere I went. People like from Kentucky delegates. I mean, they don't come to Virginia on a regular basis, but there they were, and old delegates and new delegates. They were all over the place. So I stood, and they elected me, and I was absolutely stunned. And Juanita was down, like, clapping and everything, and I felt like, I thought they were going to sing, oh, there she is, you know. Instead, they dumped all this paperwork on me and said, have a good time, you know. It's been the best thing I've ever done. If you ever have a chance to stand, by God, do it. I mean, I didn't get here to West Virginia because some little birdie heard me over, you know, talking to my home group. I probably had something to do with the fact that I've met a few people here, you know. And I've gotten to know people from all over the world. And I can call people in West Virginia my friends, and in Florida. And they're going to send me, oh my God, I'm going to go be speaking in Maine. And I have never spoken in the North. And I'm terrified because I've been 18 years in the South. I've been corrupted. And here we go, you know, and it's the best job ever. Except for the damn manila envelopes, I just have had the best time of my life. I'm ready to go. Thank you. They're electing a new one in 3 months, but I'm ready to go. But why would I want to stay home and be alone when I could have a chance to spend the time with you? Why would I want to do that? I can be here with you. One last thing, and that was when we had been married about 2 or 3 years, we decided that we were going to try a trial child. And that was my term, wasn't his. And Doug, as you know, he is as laid back that we've been compared to. He's the Chihuahua. I mean, he's the Great Dane, and I'm the Chihuahua. And he was kind of like, yeah, that's fine. We could do that. We'll have a child. And I'm thinking, yeah, right. And so I was 34, and everybody kept saying, well, it's going to take a long time for you to get pregnant. And I took off my shoes, and bingo, you know. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried, and I came out, and we had gone to a Tuesday night meeting, and I bought this test on the way to the meeting, thinking, I'm not pregnant, and went to the meeting, came home, stopped at Rally Burgers, and I went into the bathroom and came out sobbing with this sort of dripping stick, you know. And he's eating a Rally Burger, and I said, oh my God, I'm pregnant, and he said, well, I thought we wanted to be. I said, well, wanting and being are two different things, you fool. And then he ate his Rally Burger. I mean, it's just like, yeah, okay, I ate the Rally Burger. And I'm here to say, thank God babies come whether you're afraid or not, or she never made. Lindsay came, and like he said today, Lindsay Ray Staples is the most marvelous little creature on God's green earth. I mean, she's wonderful. She used to, when she was 2 or 3 years old, ride a little tricycle up and down in front of the house, and we'd say, where are you going? She'd say, I'm going to a meeting. I go to a meeting. I had an unfortunate incident happen where one of the meetings I was a regular attendee to refused to let me in with my baby, that no babies allowed. And Joe, the sponsor, said, give her to me, we'll take her in AA. And sometimes we're not very tolerant of people with children. And I'll take a woman's baby who's crying and walk up and down the hall so she can listen to the meeting, you know, be a little tolerant. We have a meeting that has a babysitting service, and Lindsay calls it the baby meeting, and she loves to go because mommy goes here and daddy goes there, and she's got a spot to go. People ask me why I keep coming back after 20 years, and that's pretty much why I keep coming back is Lindsay, because you see, I was afraid to have a child. I didn't think before I met Doug it would be a good idea, because you see, that person that hit walls and scratched her dad and, you know, just slugged her mother, and I had violent anger, and I thought I'd hurt a child. But when I met Doug and I had had enough time in the program, I thought with the help of God, the people in the program, and this wonderful man I married, maybe I could be a mother. And that's why I couldn't be a collected, sane, decent mother without this program. And I have a funny feeling when Lindsay refused, she absolutely refused to breastfeed. I mean, I wanted to be the perfect, she wouldn't do it. And they brought her a bottle and she slugged it back, and the nurse said, my God, she just can't get enough quick enough. And Doug and Joe and another guy, Pete, are going, give her to us. We'll take her to the meeting.
I don't know which side of the hallway she's going. I just don't know. But I know there's a good chance she's going to end up in one room or the other. And I know that should she need the program, that I'm too close. I'm her mom. I can't fix her. And I need you to keep coming back to be there for her when she comes through the doors. I need her to know that you're going to be there for her. And you can rest assured that I hope to be there for your children. That's why I keep coming back. I like to close with this little phrase. I collect quotes. And there's little pieces of paper that keep falling out of my ODAP. But this one was very important. And I didn't hear it in a meeting. I actually read in Parade magazine, non-conference approval literature. But it's Mother Teresa's business card, so how bad can it be? And I kind of wondered, who would ask Mother Teresa for a business card? I mean, what? But it was her card, and this is what it said, and I carry it with me, and a generous, kind soul gave me it on the bookmark, and this is what it says. The fruit of silence is prayer. The fruit of prayer is faith. The fruit of faith is love. The fruit of love is service, and the fruit of service is peace. Thank you.